Yeah, you have to be careful not to. There's a lot of art in seeming artless, yes. And you have to be careful that the wisdom of hindsight doesn't make you seem too much of a clever clogs. But it's interesting because I wrote a film about Hitler, in fact, which and there is an argument that actually. If Nazi Germany had gone to war in 1938, they would have won much quicker. And Hitler used to curse Chamberlain for Munich because it made him delay a whole year. So that is these sort of little things you feed in. But you have to make it seem authentic. You know, if only we could find some way of harnessing the power of the atom. You know, it won't do. You know, so you're often your insights are wrong or seem askew because our insights today, you know, what a blunder Tony Blair has made in Iraq. You know, who knows? In 10 years' time, we may be adding to it, you know, tenfold or not. But when you're living history. On as it happens, your judgments are often completely wide of the mark. So you in a journal, and when you're faking a journal, that's exactly the sort of thing you want to put in. Like, you know, started the wasteland, threw it across the room. You know, but you have to be very judicious about that.
Did you also have in mind the way that journal writers? Because clearly, you've kind of read some of those. 20th century, particularly journals by literary men and women. Did you have in mind the way also that they, that often, but it's a kind of interestingly sort of fictional form, even in its real versions, that, you know, when, I don't know, when I just relatively recently read John Foles's journals.
Yeah.
And he's clearly writing those thinking these are the journals of a writer, and I jolly well hope they'll be published,
yes.
And that's what they're there for. And to me, one of the pleasures of sort of Logan Mountstuart, and in a way, perhaps one of the things that licenses his sort of name dropping and his celebrity seeking, and is the fact that it seems like it's confessional, but actually it's also sort of written with an eye on sort of, with a kind of self regard, an eye on sort of how it might be seen.
Well, I think I would say Logan doesn't, because his maybe early on, when he's a pretentious young wannabe writer, he does. But as his life begins the long slide into oblivion, there's no guarantee that posterity will pay any attention to him at all. And I think you can divide journals very neatly, as like many of the binary divisions, into those that are written with an eye or two eyes on posterity, such as John Foles, which I find them fascinating because I met him once, actually, interestingly, or Virginia Woolf.
Yeah.
And I think that the great journals are the ones that are not written with a view to publication, like Pepys or Boswell in particular. Indeed, Cyril Connolly's fragment of journal that was published. And I think you can tell when you read them, because they aren't polished in a way. I think these particularly writers who are... writing their journals up to be part of their oeuvre, posthumous oeuvre, are super conscious and self-conscious, and I think it shines through. And I think you instinctively you can divide those ones from the other. And I would say, wouldn't I, that Logan's journal, apart from the earlier ones, are written unself-consciously because he comes out of them so badly. You know, there's a kind of naturalness to the confession, which a more mannered and studied journal doesn't provide.
Yeah, and whenever he meets the great sort of men and women of the 20th century, he always kind of notices, he doesn't tell us anything kind of profound they've said, or, you know, it's always James Joyce's very little head. The one thing he quotes Hemingway, you know, he quotes Hemingway and all Hemingway's saying, claim your expenses.
That's
you know?
Right. Well, you don't know when you meet these guys, you know, when you meet, I mean, he's a successful writer, and one of the criticisms was, how come Logan Mountstuart met so many well-known people? But, you know, any, you know, successful writer in the 1920s and 30s would have come across, you know, Lady Cunard at a party, or Lord Beaverbrook, or whoever. It's true, he does meet a fair number of famous people, but he's not bowled over by the celebrity because it hasn't amounted to much. I mean, if you met James Joyce in Paris, you'd have to be really quite an intellectual to be kind of in awe of meeting him. And Logan is vaguely aware of him. When he goes to Garsington, it's by accident, and he meets Lady Ottilie Morell and various other types, including Virginia Woolf there. But he's not kowtowing or thinking, gosh, aren't I lucky?
She gets quite a sort of bad...
Yes. I don't know why I have this Virginia Woolf animus in me. Maybe because I taught to the lighthouse for too long. I don't know if that's come across your desk, John, but sometimes it's a mistake to spend too much time in tutorials, you know, endlessly reading essays about To the Lighthouse. But I have a bit of an anti-Bloomsbury group thing, actually, because I think they're a bunch of, you know, minor talents who had a taste for interior decoration and who became fantastically famous for some reason. I think only John Maynard Keynes is possibly the only one who has any merit to real status. But anyway, so I allow my prejudices free rein under the guise of Logan Mountstuart, including Jackson Pollock, another of my bête noire. It was a wonderful opportunity to foam at the mouth, you know, without drawing down too much flack.
Yeah, you know that the Penguin publish your books, and the Penguin Online Book Club, they have an online book club, but their online book club is a real reading group. It's a different one, I think, each week, which sort of is... And the one for Any Human Heart was from the Shetlands. Did you know that?
No, I haven't.
They haven't read it. And it didn't, they debated very intensively exactly this question. You know, would it have been possible to meet all these people? And G felt it was artificial, the way Logan met everyone. M pointed out, though, but if you'd been involved in, for example, the Bloomsbury set, you would have met all these people.
Well, I am a writer in the 21st century, and I think of the people I've met in my life, and it's extraordinary. I've met, without seeking them out, but just my working life as a writer and as a film writer, I've met a most astonishing number of people, from Sylvester Stallone to the Queen. You know, how did that happen? You know, imagine if Logan Mountstuart, people said, come off it, you must be joking. So he's met the Duchess of Windsor and Pablo Picasso. But I think you do, if you have any kind of, if you're a writer and you have any kind of success as Logan did, or one of the models for Logan Mountstuart is this completely forgotten English writer called William Gerhardy, who was in the 1920s the leading young novelist in Britain, and he was taken up by everybody, and he was going to all the right parties. Lord Beaverbrook and the Express Group took him up as the great white hope of British letters. And he wrote two, I think, rather brilliant novels, and then it was all sort of downhill from there. His last novel was published in 1940, and he died in 1977. So 37 years of silence. I mean, he's a terrible warning to all writers. It can all go very pear-shaped if you're not careful. And so Gerhardy's career, in a way, is Logan's career. Mm. But Gerhardy knew everyone from Indian Maharanis to film stars to Evelyn Waugh to Graham Greene, who were all young writers who admired him hugely, and I think Evelyn Waugh ripped him off shamelessly. It's totally plausible, is what I'm saying. Totally plausible.
But you're also interested, aren't you? You must be interested, because you do it in a different way in The New Confessions, in writing a novel which sort of spans a lot of history, not just an historical novel, lots of people do that, but a novel which finds a way of actually giving us, you know, much of the 20th century, and these characters are kind of leading characters of the 20th century. I mean, is that must be a kind of preoccupation, given that you do it twice in sort of very different ways in the two books. Yeah,
yes, I think I have sometimes wanted to write a big book, you know, a big novel, and often you think that covers many years, and these two novels in particular cover many decades. But I think I'm interested in the way history brushes up against all our individual lives, and sometimes the great events pass us by completely. You know, you overslept on 9/11, you know, or else I knew somebody on the Lockerbie flight, the Pan Am flight. So suddenly, events that are iconic or enshrined in contemporary history have touched you in a way. And I think what I'm interested in these books, and indeed in something like Restless, the new novel, which is World War II effect, is how the individual's life moves on its own path, and sometimes it touches on events that are very significant and important, and other times are the great historical moments of that time are utterly irrelevant because you're madly in love, or you're having a nervous breakdown, or you're living elsewhere. So I think it's trying to bring history down to the individual life as we all live it, and I'm sure all of us in this room have in some way touched on some history. You were in a certain place at a certain time, or you knew somebody. You know, I never thought I would know a writer who was executed by a military government, but I did. I knew Ken Saro-Wiwa very well, and he was hung by the Nigerian military government, and I was very much drawn into the whole fight to get him released. And then we failed and he died, and I'm still involved in his life, but having lived in Nigeria and having left it, I was drawn back into Nigerian politics in a way I never imagined. And it's that sort of thing that I'm interested in capturing in these big books, as it were. But I know the novel I'm going to write next, I think it's going to be another long one, but it's going to cover only 4 or 5 months in time. But I think it's going to be another 500 pager. So somehow the idea seizes you, and you think, no, I'm going to write, it's not a State of England novel, it's more a State of London novel, but I know I need a big canvas to do it on. So you kind of, you know, go to the gym, as it were, and work out, get ready for it. And then other times another type of novel suggests itself to you. But I think in these ones, that's what interests me. I mean, I look back at my own life and I see certain moments that are strangely significant. With hindsight, again, it's the view back is the clear view. The view ahead is blind or wishful. I see that I was in certain places and certain things happened to me that were significant. You know, I was living in Nigeria during the Nigerian Civil War, and it had a profound effect on me. I mean, it's probably a minor event in the history of the 20th century, but you know, I was there at the time, you know, unreflectingly. So these things are what interest me, and people I've met. You know, I met, for example, Dodi Fayed. How bizarre is that? Dodi Fayed wanted to make a film of A Good Man in Africa, my first novel. So I was in Los Angeles, and I went to his house, and his butler opened the door, and I was with the director of the film. And, of course, we immediately thought, absolutely no way how we could have anything to do with this man. He was charming, soft-spoken. He says, I have lots of money. What do you mean? My dad has lots of money. And so we said, we had the cup of tea and chatted about the film. And as we left, Bruce Beresford, the director, said, forget it, you know. But he wouldn't let go. So he kept pursuing us. So I had another meeting with Dodi Fayed in London, in my house. It's bizarre to think he was trying to persuade me to make a film with him. And then, you know, history takes its course. And so that in a way, it's a perfect example of two totally insignificant. I've met so many bullshit producers in my life, and here was just another one. But somehow, because he had this affair with Princess Diana and has become enshrined in popular mythology, I can now say, you know, Dodi Fayed sat in that chair, you know. It's a curious, banal example of how your own random, chance-driven life, you know, drives you into contact with people who may, you know, have some kind of notoriety or vague temporary historical significance.
I mean, the key ones in some ways in any human heart, almost all of the characters, the historical characters one meets, are writers or painters, who in a way are kind of wonderfully, I don't know, in a historical novel there's something, it seems to me, kind of almost inherently comic about them, because they pursue their own things, almost oblivious to the grand occurrence of history. But you do, I mean, two big characters are the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, and aren't they? Because they're not just there. They sort of have some. His life becomes tangled up with theirs. He doesn't just meet them. He's sort of forced to become there, to watch over them. And then there's this kind of curious sort of, is it an aspect of the plot or isn't it that. He's betrayed on a wartime mission and imprisoned for a long time, and he has this kind of feeling that it's because he hasn't cooperated with them and one of their nefarious schemes. Why were they the ones that you picked as the?
It's interesting because I in the 1980s I had a friend who was living in the Bahamas, and I used to go and stay with him. On a holiday from time to time. And in the Bahamas, there was this notorious murder in 1943 of this multimillionaire called Sir Harry Oakes. And it's still a very hot issue. And I was almost thrown out of a drinks party in the Bahamas because I was asking people about Harry Oakes. I became very intrigued by the murder of Harry Oakes. And it happened when the Duke of Windsor was governor of the Bahamas in the war. And so I read, there are about 8 books that have been written about the murder of Harry Oakes, and I met an attorney general of the Bahamas, and I learned certain other things. And there's a whole raft of conspiracy theories. Was the Duchess having an affair with Harry Oakes? Was it to do with the mafia who were trying to build a casino in the Bahamas, etc., etc.? But actually, once you get to the bottom of it, everybody knows who killed Harry Oakes. He was a man called Harold Christie, who was a property developer, who was knighted, of course, never made a fortune, got off with it. But it's, you know, it's in the Bahamas, it's still a very touchy subject. Harry Oakes' son is still alive. The whole thing is a can of worms. And presiding over this can of worms is the Duke of Windsor, because I believe he conspired to pervert the course of justice in the case of the murder of Harry Oates, which I prove conclusively in any human heart. I'll be very brief about it. Harry Oates was bludgeoned to death in his house, and then they tried to set his bed on fire and the house on fire and failed, the assailants. Sleeping next door was his house guest, Harold Christie, who never heard a thing or smelt smoke or anything. This was a shock. It was because small little corrupt island community, the richest man on the island is murdered. Duke of Windsor, who's in exile effectively for the duration of the war because of his pro-Nazi sympathies, has this terrible problem. What does he do? Summons 2 Miami detectives. He had a perfectly good CID on the island to solve the case. And they solve it by planting the fingerprint of the prime suspect, Harry Oakes' son-in-law, a sort of remittance man from Martinique, who playboy figure, planted a fingerprint in the murder room, and with the Duke's collusion. In the trial, a brilliant defense lawyer proved the corruption of the 2 Miami detectives, and de Marigny, the accused, was acquitted. End of story. Hang on. If de Marigny's acquitted, the murderer must still be at large. Has anybody interviewed the Duke of Windsor? Oh, no, he happens to be in Canada at the moment. The whole thing was a massive cover-up. And the case, effectively, is still open because they just stopped investigating it because of the Duke. And so I got very, so I thought, well, this is one of, again, one of the wonderful things about writing a novel. You can get all these things out of your system. And so that's why I lit upon the Duke and Duchess as characters in the novel. And I researched them very diligently and talked to people who had known the Duchess, particularly later
in life. Did she stand too close to people when she spoke to
them? Yes, I think she did. She was a great seductress. But I think that, and again, this is where fiction often enshrines truths that non-fiction can't. You know, fiction can go where historians and journalists aren't allowed. And so I took great care of my portrait of the Duke and Duchess, and I have a feeling, though I can't prove it, that actually that it's very close to what they were like. And it's not all bad. You know, the Duchess was actually quite a good governor's wife. She endured, and she called the Bahamas this moron paradise, but she behaved quite well. She, you know, opened her charities, even though her restaurant was segregated. It was only because that's how the island worked in those days. But I feel that they step off the pages of the novel as real people, rather than the slightly cardboard cutouts that they are, that they seem to be in the biographies you read or the histories of the time. So they're only there because of my fascination with the murder of Harry Oakes and my determination to solve it. So that's the explanation. So tough luck on them, but there's no doubt that the Duke, he wasn't laundering money in Mexico, he wasn't having an affair, the Duchess wasn't having an affair with Harry Oakes, but if de Marigny had been hung for the murder of Harry Oakes, the Duke would have been a very happy man indeed, which I think is sort of shameful.
And it's funny, this the involvement, perhaps, we don't know, we're never told, with a plot that your Logan Lanstewart becomes entangled with, and he thinks, am I being paranoid? Or because one thing, I mean, it's one of the last things I wanted to ask you before I throw it open to your readers. One of the things about doing a journal, and again, your readers in the Shetlands were very exercised by this, was whether its avoidance of some of the shape that you expect from novels was a kind of good thing or a bad thing, whether for a writer it's a liberating thing or a difficulty, because you can do with a, you know, in a way with a journal, in a way that you would, I think, find surprising if the novel were a sort of a normal third person past tense account. We meet quite important characters, for instance, who are then left behind, as in life they might be. And you know, up in the Shetlands, they were saying, you know, what happens to Lan Fotheringay, what happens to her, you know? And if it were, I mean, of course, you know, if it were a Dickens novel, they'd all come back in the last few chapters, and we would, but actually it doesn't take a Victorian novel to want to do that sort
of thing. No, and I think it's true, but then what story do our lives tell? And this is in a way the ambition of any human heart, is to tell the story of a life. And we know people who we were intense friends with, and we just lose touch with them in the most absurd way. You don't see them again. I just met somebody the other day who I was at school with, who I hadn't seen for 35 years, and he said, "Why haven't we been in touch with each other?" I said, "I don't know. We just haven't." And so I wanted to be like life, like and like life. And my great exemplar in this case is, I think, possibly my favorite writer is Chekhov. And Chekhov said, this is in 1890, he said, it's high time writers realized that there is no making out anything in this life. And so the concept of the well-structured story where all the loose ends are neatly tied up at the end is completely unlifelike. So if you're writing a realistic novel, which is what I am, a realistic novelist, I want my novels, the world of my novels and the characters in my novels to seem absolutely real, and for readers to be seduced by the world of my novels and to believe in what's happening. If I then introduced Lan Fotheringill at the end as an 85-year-old woman, Logan, how wonderful to see you, it would be unlifelike. And so I wanted it to be absolutely real. And so, as I said, there was a lot of art in making it seem artless. So these loose ends, or when he spends half an hour, half a page writing about his diarrhea, you know, and that's more human than, say, thinking, I wonder what happened to that young girl I met at Somerville College, Oxford, in the 1920s. Life isn't like that, and this is what Chekhov realised. This is why I think he's possibly the preeminently influential writer on the 20th century. He realised that life is formless, driven by chance, people don't connect, it's very funny, it's also very tragic. You know, life is a complex tragic comedy, but it doesn't have any loose ends tied up. So that's what I was trying to write.